From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you could change one thing from your past, what would it be? For world-renowned concert pianist Leon Fleischer, it was to be able to play piano again.
The fifth and fourth fingers in my right hand began progressively to curl under until after about 10 months, they were firmly dug into the palm of my hand, and I could only straighten them out with enormous effort.
This hour, we're going to consider our regrets, our personal regrets, and the regrets of human history, as with the story of a little girl named Hannah and her suitcase.
There are three characters in the story. There is Hannah Brady, who was born on May 16, 1931, in Nové Město, Czechoslovakia, and died in a gas chamber at Auschwitz at the age of 13. There's Fumiko Ishioka, this wonderful Japanese woman who was so dedicated to sharing Hannah's story with Japanese kids that she spent almost a year searching the world for it. And it's the story of George, who is Hannah's brother.
But first, Steve Paulson talks with Kerry Sudler, a man who discovered his family once owned slaves.
When I was growing up, my father would talk about it now and then with sort of a sense of pride, and I didn't think that much of it because, you know, didn't everybody own slaves? I mean, you sort of assume it. It's kind of like if you eat a certain kind of food all the time, you assume everybody else does. You know, we had this grandfather clock that was built in the early 1700s and all this sort of legacy, and I just didn't pay much attention. And when he died, I inherited a family Bible that was written in this quill ink, or passages, pages and pages of it, in the mid-1700s, and in it, it listed humans and what they had sold for in shillings and pounds and early dollars, and it was just so clinical. It was shocking to me because this is not the experience of everybody else. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really kind of troubling to me, and I didn't really understand it, and also, honestly, I didn't really believe it. I mean, can this be true?
Well, and in fact, I'd like to read a few entries from the Sudler family record because I think it really puts it in black and white, just what we're talking about here. Let me just read a few entries, and I'm quoting here. Memorandum, December 1801, bought two Negro boys, 210 pounds, of Mr. George Tull, Vic's Jock and Jack, and the said Tull sold one Negro woman named Sarah to Michael Murray for $100. Judah had a little one in the cornfield while gathering peas, Wednesday, September 25th, 1811, boy child named Pedum. Arnold ran away on Whit Sunday, May 21st, 1825, and was taken up in the Delaware State on Monday the 23rd by Mr. Peter Stewart. Tubman Sudler went up after Arnold on Thursday the 26th. It really makes it very real, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And you wonder what your part is in this. I mean, of course I wasn't alive then. Most of my white friends or white associates will say, hey, it wasn't you, you weren't there. But something occurred to me a few years ago, which is really simple, that if I choose to carry my family's name, and there might be some good stuff attached to that, you know, I have to really carry its full legacy. You can't just be all the good stuff and then deselect all the icky part and just show the world the highlight reel. Because much of the social access, if you will, that I have is clearly earned on the backs of other people and on their arms and legs.
You did something pretty unusual. After you discovered this family history, you went out with a tape recorder and talked to a lot of relatives, some on the black side, some on the white side. And we have a bit of tape from a white Sudlerville relative, 80-year-old William Sudler Goodhand, showing that racism is not just a thing of the past.
Colored people, to me, in my lifetime here, were never any kind of a hindrance or any kind of anything. They were just what was here. That was part of the way life was. So nobody, there was never, I didn't know of any animosity when I was a young fellow. I didn't know of any. And as you pick and choose your friends, we pick and choose ours, and they pick and choose theirs, and everybody got along pretty well. And like the colored man today, that as he gets his education and as he acts more like he should act, like a human being should act, he is accepted more and more. And the only thing that keeps him from not being completely accepted is they are different.
That's really something.
Yeah, it is. Steve, to have been standing on a plantation that once was a slave plantation and is now surrounded by soybeans and corn and this and that, and to have a guy 9 generations later, still family, sipping on iced tea or a mint julep, whatever it was, and tell you about colored people. What was odd to me is after 80 years, I thought, well, how many have you met with the last name and what are they like? And of course, not a finger had ever been lifted to go meet them.
Well, you did something quite unusual. You chased down a lot of relatives, descendants of your family's slaves who actually have the same name as you, Carrie Sudler. Let's hear another bit of tape.
I have to say I was a little nervous to call because part of the reason I'm calling is that the reason that you and I probably have the same last name is not through the best circumstances in history.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, this may sound a little weird, but I just want to apologize for any difficulty that life is as far as racism and all the rest of it. And I want to let you know that you have somebody with the same last name who's interested in having a level playing field for everybody, and that I don't suppose the white side of the family ever apologized to the black side. I really don't know if they ever did or didn't, but I just want to let you know that it does not continue even in silence.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate that and certainly welcome that. So that's a good feeling that goes with that. Let me assure you there are no issues with me along those lines, trying to understand all the things that happened. I guess it's more important to me just to try to understand, you know, what went on.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm thrilled just the fact that you called.
So you deliberately set out to apologize to some of the black descendants of your family slaves.
Yeah, I couldn't find any record, and I don't know of any instance where my family has ever officially or formally or informally apologized to any of these people. And there are hundreds of them and hundreds of them out there, descendants. And I think it has to happen. I think it's important that they know that they're important people, as important as I am or you are or anything else. And that if I don't do anything about this, it just continues, and a larger invisible oppression continues, and I'm a participant of it.
How did you feel doing this, making these kinds of apologies?
I was scared. I have to admit that. I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I didn't know if they were going to yell, you know, swear at me or hit me or I don't know. It was really a major, you know, felt really risky to do it. But I had to do it. I had to do it. And whatever was going to happen would have been worth it. And it has been worth it.
We have another bit of tape. And I think this is a response of a black settler you met in a store near your old family plantation.
Your white skin gives you access to almost anything that you want. I'm followed in grocery stores and I'm followed in department stores still. Is it better? Yeah, it's better in my own lifetime. It's better. But it's not perfect. It hasn't improved. And white people still say, yeah, I have black friends, and they say that I'm not racist. But if you have to make that statement, then there must be some racism somewhere. I certainly am racist still. I still have to work past all of that stuff because there's jealousy, envy, and sometimes hate when I look at the things that other people have access to that I don't have.
What did you say to that person?
I was talking about access, and I had been in the White House earlier that day because I talked my way into it, which I know how to do. And I really didn't know what to do, so I small talked the guy up in the beginning and just asked him, you know, what's it like to walk around in a town with this name? It's your last name, but you're not the white guy, so maybe you don't feel the same. And he really did turn and just put it to me really brutally like that. And what a wake-up call, because it never occurred to me that if he and I were shopping in the same place, that the security guys are going to be following him around just because he's black. And maybe I'm the one stealing, but he's the one that they follow just because of his skin color. You know, one of the other conversations we had is that ever since he was born, he was taught that he was lazy and stupid and ugly. I mean, imagine growing up your whole life thinking you're lazy, stupid, and ugly, and all of your people are too. So you never really kind of climb out of that because you're told it's hopeless and don't even bother. And here I was raised not to think that I was stupid or lazy or ugly, but that I can do whatever I want and be the next president, that kind of thing. He was never told that. So I was handed a whole different kind of access, two people with the same name, except one is black and one is white. And here he is just trying to buy a shirt, and they're tracking him down like a dog. It's just really wrong, you know?
What did you say to him? Did you tell him you're sorry?
I did. I said, you know, I would like to apologize for the way that your life is right now and any participation that my family may have had in it in the last several hundred years in creating a world that is the way it is for you right now, that you were brought here against your will, your family, your great-great-great-great-grandfather 9 generations ago, maybe in chains, you know, maybe whatever went on that was really painful that has created a reality for him today that is so much more difficult than my reality, and needlessly so. I really don't know what you say to somebody. I mean, I wasn't given the manual or the lessons on how to do this, and I've gone it alone. And a lot of white people really resent me and think that I have no business doing this. I wasn't there. It wasn't my fault. But I carry my family's name, and I carry what it's done, both good and bad. What do you do in life? You just try and do the next right thing, even if you don't understand it.
Carrie Sudler, talking with Steve Paulson.
Echo!
I'm Jim Fleming. Any regrets? Why not send us an email at www.ttbook.org? We'd love to hear from you. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
If I could change one thing about my past, what would it be? That's a tough question.
What would I change about my life?
I really don't know. Perhaps
When I was very young, I didn't have too much confidence in myself.
There's nothing I would want to change about my past. I like my past.
That's correct.
A lot of stuff, man. Don't get me started. Next question.
Then I never had problems.
I would have been a better sister and defended her when others made fun of her.
I wouldn't have let Keith Pubblehum throw me headfirst into the gym wall in sixth grade.
I wish I would have came out earlier to my parents.
I'd break more rules.
Prison sentences, being in prison.
When I was a kid, I was a child soldier in southern Sudan. So if I could change that, I would never be a child soldier again.
I think I'd like to forgive whom I didn't forgive.
The past, that's all I can say. Just the past.
Recognize this song? It's one of the Beatles' early recordings, Hello Little Girl. You can hear John, Paul, George, and Pete. That's right, Pete Best, the Beatles drummer before Ringo Starr. In fact, it was Pete's mother, Mona, who played a key role in the formation of the band. When she opened the Casbah Coffee Club in the basement of her house in Liverpool, she went looking for an opening night band. George Harrison and Ken Brown recruited two old buddies, John Lennon and Paul McCartney. They called themselves the Quarrymen. Not long after that, Pete Best became the group's drummer. Why Pete Best was kicked out of the band remains something of a mystery to this day, but one thing's clear. For Pete, the timing could not have been worse. Just a few months after he left the band in the summer of 62, the Beatles landed their first number one hit, Love Me Do, and they soon went on to make music history. And Pete Best? Well, he kicked around with a few bands before settling into a career as a civil servant in Liverpool. In 1988, Pete once again picked up his drumsticks and formed the Pete Best Band, and now he's put out a book called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. He told Steve Paulson that he joined the Beatles right before they went to Hamburg.
I got a phone call from Paul McCartney, which basically turned around and said, you know, we've got the offer to go to Germany. Would you be interested in taking over the drummer's role? And I went down the following day to the Wyvern Club, which later became the Blue Angel. Got down there, played about six numbers that consisted of the audition, and after about 10 minutes they went away in a corner, had a little bit of a tete-a-tete, and then they came back and turned around and said, Pete, you're in. And that's the way I acquired the drummer's role with the Beatles.
What kind of people were John, Paul and George?
George was the youngest guy. Even from, you know, the first instance, he was very much into wanting to improve his guitar technique, so he was rehearsing, practicing, making sure. He wanted to be the best guitarist around. Paul, very much the PR-orientated guy, wanted the public to know, the world to know what was happening. Again, a brilliant musician, very self-assured, very self-composed. John was the, I suppose you could turn around and say, the clown of the band. He had this sardonic, caustic-witted humour. And it was something which was, you know, I took a liking to because I became, you know, very close to John. But I actually saw another side of John, which was a very tender and a very loving side. And when you actually put those two components together, John was the complete person as far as I was concerned.
Now, you played with the Beatles for a couple of years, from 1960 to 62. How much of the Beatles' essential sound do you think was established during that period?
I think the vast majority of it, to be quite honest, simply because of the fact that, the kindred hours we put in, you know, the killing hours we did in Germany. We were playing six, 7 hours a night, six, 7 nights a week. You know, even if you didn't realise it, it was taking place. We were becoming tight, we were becoming energetic. The sound was improving, it was becoming more raw, it was becoming more powerhouse and more savage. The image was changing. And, of course, it was through that hard schooling in Hamburg. When we came back to Liverpool, you know, and we were doing exactly the same as we did in Hamburg, it just basically took the Liverpool audiences by storm. So really, you know, the sound and the creation, the early creation I'm talking about, took place during, the, you know, those two kindred years.
Swinging her hips, splitting up a bag of potato chips. And three cool cats do three big flips for three cool chicks. Yeah, three cool chicks.
Now, you played a lot of gigs with the Beatles, both in Liverpool and in Germany. Weren't you also, for a while, handling the books? You were actually the manager, in a sense?
Yes, I assumed the mantle prior to Brian Epstein, and I handled the business side of things.
One day in August of 1962, Brian Epstein told you that you were out. You were no longer going to be part of the Beatles, and Ringo Starr was going to replace you. Was this a complete surprise?
It was, simply because the fact there'd been no real forewarning at all about it. I'd been with the band for 2 years. We'd recorded with Polydor. We'd got the recording contract with EMI. It did come as a complete surprise because, you know, all of this was taking place. We were on an upward roll. We decided on what our first release was going to be, which was Love Me Doing, P.S. I Love You. But then I was called into the office around about mid-August 1962, and one night I was a Beatle, and the next morning I was no longer there.
Why do you think that happened? Why were you fired?
I don't know. I mean, the reason that was given, that I wasn't a good enough drummer, has never held up water, never will, and there's lots of people in Liverpool who support me from that particular area, and even today, you know, travelling around the world and playing with my own band, the Pete Best Band. They've looked at my drumming ability and basically turned around and said, no, you have a style of your own, which was very credible. You know, you were rated and reputed to be one of the best drummers in Liverpool. We can see why. So that particular aspect of it never held up water.
Now, there have been a couple of other explanations that have been put forward. One is that the other Beatles were actually jealous of you because you were this good-looking guy and apparently a lot of the girls flocked around you. And another explanation is that you didn't quite fit in with the rest of the lads, that you held yourself a little bit separate.
I think that's hard to sort of swallow as well. Again, this is things which people sort of point out and they try and, you know, turn around and say that was the reason for it. They may have assumed it. Something which happened in Hamburg, people have got hold of it. I think in Hamburg, people turn around and said I was a little bit of a loner. I was alone simply because of the fact I was a drummer. I broke sticks. I used to have to go into town by myself. I was the one who used to get out of bed early, right? The others were still there. Sometimes we'd go into town together, but if, you know, if they weren't prepared to go into town, I had to knead sticks. That used to be, you know, the only time that it was separate. If you turn around and say you didn't quite fit in, answer me one question. Why did it take them 2 years to suddenly realise that I couldn't have fitted in?
I understand a lot of fans in Liverpool were furious, and there were practically riots at some of the performances once Ringo was part of the band. People chanted, Pete forever, Ringo never.
Yes, that did happen. It was very heartwarming. You know, there was petitions sent to the Merseybeat. George Harrison got a black eye off an irate fan. Brian was threatened. Deep down inside, it was very heartwarming, but I think I realised that no matter what they did, even though there was a show of force and a show of love, they couldn't reverse the decision.
Now, just a few months after you were booted out, the Beatles' song Love Me Do became this enormous hit, and then next year they were huge. They were an international phenomenon. You must have been pretty bitter.
I think initially it wasn't so much them becoming the international phenomenon. That was something, you know, the icons in the music industry, this, you know, incredible reputation they acquired. That was something, if you look back in hindsight and you're totally truthful, that was beyond, you know, the realms of our belief at that time. But what the annoying factor was, yes, the self-belief we had in ourselves that we were going to get a record into the English charts was starting to take shape. It was that initial first release. That was the one which started everything. Then, of course, after that, you know, it was followed up with, you know, other number ones. That was where the pain came in, because you were that close to it.
Now, there actually is a recording of Love Me Do when you were still there. You're on the drums. What do you think of the recording that you did?
I've always said it was good. I mean, you know, the version which was released on the anthology after many, many years, It was a version which we laid down to give George Martin a sample of the type of music that we were playing, to give him an idea of, you know, the harmonies. You know, there were possible changes which could have been made to it. But it was there. It was basically to turn around and show him that this was the type of music that we wanted to play. This was going to be our first release.
Love, love me do. You know I love you. I'll always be true. So please, love me do.
Now, when the Beatles anthology came out in the mid-90s, it featured 10 songs with you on drums, and I suppose it was maybe the first time when you kind of had official status as being one of the original Beatles. Was that a gratifying moment for you?
It was. You know, a lot of people have always looked at the financial view of it. The financial aspect of it was great. I wasn't expecting it, a little bit icing on the cake.
You got some royalties for the first time.
That's right, yes. You know, after many, many years, I did actually receive something, you know, for, you know, my work as a Beatle, you know, royalty-wise. But the other side of the coin was the fact that Anthology 1, I was on 10 tracks out of 60. It was a little bit like, well, you know, maybe this is their way of turning around and saying thank you for services rendered in the past.
You sort of kicked around for a while, sort of seeing if you could make it as a musician. You ended up working most of your career as a civil servant in the job center there. Were you kind of left alone, or were you hounded at all as being one of the first Beatles?
I think the recognition was there. You know, at that time, I still lived in Liverpool. I still walked the streets in Liverpool. I still drank in the same pubs. When I actually started, it was a little bit of a surprise to people. So, yes, there was an air of curiosity. There was an air of puzzlement. You know, Liverpoolians are outspoken. They'll look across the desk and turn around and say, "Aren't you the so-and-so who played for the Beatles? You know, what the hell are you doing working in the job centre?" And, you know, you explain the position to them, you have a laugh and a joke, and at the end of the day, they realise that, OK, you are trying to, you know, persevere and gain security for your own family.
Now, I understand you are now in your early 60s, and you've had a lot of years to think back on, well, over your career, over your life, what might have been if you had stayed with the Beatles. How do you put things in perspective when they became so big, so huge, and you had an entirely different life?
I think it's something you accept. It's something you'd entered into through your own volition. Yes, there was there's still an enigma about the dismissal, but you have to adjust your own lifestyle. And I think if you're content with what you're doing, you're pleased with what you're doing, and you're happy with what you've achieved music-wise, and what you've achieved family-wise, family is number one. You know, if you've provided security for them, you've made sure that they've grown up with a good roof over their heads, they've had a good education, I think you've done well, and it's a decision you make. The accolades which come from that are superficial, but it's wonderful to be in a position where you can turn around and say, yes, I've enjoyed life regardless of what happened 40-odd years ago. I've still got my health, I've still got my happiness, I've still got my humour. I'm still respected as a musician, you know, whether it be as an ex-Beatle or Pete in his own right. I've still got a wonderful family. I've still got brothers who stand around me. I've got two wonderful daughters, a wonderful wife. I've got four wonderful grandchildren who I idolise and spoil soft, and most probably always will. I've got a great band, you know, which is doing well. We're accepted. We're pulling crowds in. You know, people are enjoying it. People are starting to talk about the Pete Best Band in its own right. When you put all that together and you put it into perspective, I feel that I'm the fortunate one. I think I'm the lucky one.
You're so young and I'm so old. This my garden I've been told. I don't care just what they say, 'cause forever I will pray. You and I will be as free as the birds up in the trees.
The song Diana, played by the Pete Best Band. Pete and his brothers Rogue and Rory have put out a book called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. It's the story of the Casbah Coffee Club in Liverpool, which will soon reopen to the public. Forty years ago, Leon Fleischer was one of the world's most celebrated pianists. He played with the leading symphonies of the day, like George Sell's Cleveland Orchestra. But at the height of his career, disaster struck. Leon Fleischer developed a rare neurological disorder called dystonia. His right hand could no longer play the piano. At age 35, his big concert career was finished, at least for the next 35 years. Fleischer says his story comes right out of Greek mythology. When the gods want to hit you, they know where to strike.
Practical result was over a period of 10 months, the fifth and fourth fingers in my right hand began progressively to curl under until after about 10 months, they were firmly dug into the palm of my hand, and I could only straighten them out with enormous effort.
You must have felt betrayed by your body at that point. You were one of the world's premier pianists.
You say it more convincingly than I could.
You never stopped playing, though.
No, I never stopped experimenting, trying this way, that way. For the 35 years, every day I would try the hand. But on the other hand, I did eventually, after a what you might call a mourning period of a couple of years where I just wallowed in despair, I then began to teach much more extensively and I think much better. I began to conduct and I began to look into the left-hand repertoire, which is rather considerable.
Well, one of the practical effects of that, I would think, is that the music of the right hand stayed in your head over those 35 years while your right hand refused to cooperate.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Yes, and I would try every day, in one way or another, to play with my right hand. I tested it every day for 35 years.
How many different things did you try? You went to a lot of doctors over the years and underwent a lot of tests to try to figure out what was going wrong. Did you ever keep track?
No, I defy you to name a potential therapy that I haven't tried.
Well, I know that I've read that you tried Rolfing, you tried L-Dopa, you tried...
Yeah, Rolfing actually was very helpful. That's a positive result of my searches. It's a kind of deep tissue manipulation that helps decontract the very fibers of the tissue. That's good. In fact, that helped prepare my arm, be ready for the eventual symptomatic relief that I received, which was with Botox.
Who was it who finally accurately diagnosed your problem?
NIH, National Institutes of Health, here in Maryland, in Bethesda. They had started a program for musicians with this common problem that they called dystonia. Mm-hmm. And I went down, became part of their clinical trials, and it worked.
They inject Botox directly into your hand?
Actually, they inject it into the forearm. They inject it into that point where the nerve informs the muscle to contract. Mm. And the Botox erects a kind of barrier. The message doesn't get through, so the fingers remain extended.
In a way, then, you're paralyzing your hand in order to free it.
Well, yes. You're absolutely right. Not many people pick up on that. It's a kind of weakening of the overworking muscle.
And once you had those injections, once the block was in place, so your hand didn't feel the need to contract, there must have been an extraordinary amount of work. I mean, I keep thinking about where the music was all those years while the hand refused to take it.
It's hidden somewhere up above the shoulder, the elbow. I mean, it was all there. You know, just had no way of coming on down through the forearm and hands and fingers.
What was it like then when you were finally able to watch your hand again moving freely on the keys?
It's everything that you could possibly imagine. Yeah, it was quite ecstatic.
Over all these years, you have had to approach music differently because you had only one hand and the rest of your body and your brain to play. Do you think you're a better pianist because of this?
I probably am. I think I'm a better musician. And as a result, then, perhaps on a certain level, maybe a better pianist. It's that improved and grew in relation to what my ear heard, and therefore my requirements grew and my requirements changed. Mm-hmm.
You've had to think about it. I mean, I keep coming back to this notion that your right hand knew still after 35 years what to do. Most people practice hours and hours a day in order to be able to do
Well, that's very interesting, and I think it's basically, I know it sounds rather brutal, but basically it's a waste of time.
Really?
As my teacher said, precept number one from Polonius Schnabel, you must hear before you play. Now, everybody thinks he has it ass backwards. You know, it wasn't his native language. He didn't quite know how to speak. But he was absolutely precise. You must have in your inner ear the exact sound of what you're going for. You must have your ideal. You must have your goal in your inner ear before you put down a note. Once you put down a note without purpose or without intention, you can't retrieve it. It's gone. You have to build the rest of your piece on an accident, you know? So you must hear before you play, and that's the whole point of making music, so that it's not just accidental. It's not the fingers that make the music. It's your inner ear that makes the music. And it's the fingers that you train to reproduce what's in your inner ear.
So all of these years you've been playing?
In effect, absolutely. Yes, I've been sharpening and refining and, that which I hear.
So that when the day came, was it a day when you could move your fingers again?
Yeah, the day that they shot me up with Botox.
Oh, it was right away then?
Yeah.
It was immediate?
Yeah.
You could sit down at the piano right then? And
yes, there was a lousy old upright they sat me at, and I started playing.
What did you play?
Oh, D minor Brahms. Didn't have an orchestra, unfortunately, but that was okay. Yeah.
Well, after you'd succeeded in getting back, what did you do, run home and play everything you could think of?
Pretty much. Pretty much.
Well, the other astonishing thing about your story is that not only are you able to play again, but you've made a recording.
Yeah.
At the age of 75.
Six. Oh, actually, technically speaking, you're right. I was 75 when I made it, and I've now passed over to 76.
You'd been here almost 76 years by the time you did it.
Yeah.
That's a gutsy thing to do. It had been, almost 40 years since the previous
solo two-handed work. Yes, you're absolutely right. It was actually great fun.
How did you decide what to play?
Well, there were pieces that I am very fond of. One of them was my mother's favorite piece, the Chopin D-flat Nocturne. And then it seemed kind of logical to go over from a Polish night piece to a French night piece, like the Clair de Lune. The Schubert B-flat Sonata is one of my all-time favorites. And the Bach, the two Bach transcriptions really kind of establish a mood or a zone that I wanted to communicate.
Leon Fleischer playing Schubert's B-flat Sonata. The recording is on his recent album called Two Hands.
Coming up, the story of a group of Japanese schoolchildren and what they discovered inside Hannah's suitcase.
The Holocaust is so enormous. It's hard to comprehend, it's hard to find a way in, and I think one reason that dumpy old brown suitcase captured the imagination of those kids is because it was a way into understanding a story that is almost impossible to understand.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
There are some stories, once you hear them, you just can't forget. Like this one. It's about a suitcase that once belonged to a little girl named Hannah. She was killed in the Holocaust. The discovery of her suitcase had a profound impact on many people some 60 years later.
There are three characters in the story. There is Hannah Brady, who was born on May 16, 1931, in Nové Město, Czechoslovakia, and died in a gas chamber at Auschwitz at the age of 13. There's Fumiko Ishioka, this wonderful Japanese woman who was so dedicated to sharing Hannah's story with Japanese kids that she spent almost a year searching the world for it. And it's the story of George, who is Hannah's brother.
That's Karen Levine, a producer for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. She made a radio documentary about Hannah Brady, and now she's written a children's book called Hannah's Suitcase. Levine told Anne Strainchamps about the remarkable series of events stemming from the discovery of this old suitcase.
Fumiko runs a very tiny Holocaust Education Resource Center for Children in Tokyo, and she obtained a loan of five objects from the museum at Auschwitz: a sock, a shoe, a sweater, a can of poison gas, and the suitcase. And the suitcase, a plain old brown suitcase, had a name on it.
Why do you think Fumiko and the children were so drawn to this simple suitcase?
It was the only object she received that had a name on it. So right there, there was clearly a story behind this particular suitcase. And Fumiko says, and I think she's right, that suitcases represent journeys. And in that sense, it's easy to imagine what might have happened to the suitcase and to its owner. So the kids just peppered her with questions about Hannah Brady. Who was she? What did she put in her suitcase? Where did she go? What happened to her? And Fumiko gives full credit to the kids, actually, for pushing her to go out and search for the story behind the suitcase.
So what did Fumiko do?
She wrote to the museum at Auschwitz, where the suitcase originally came from, and they said they knew nothing. She wrote to Holocaust museums all over the world, trying to find out any information about this girl, turning up absolutely nothing. And then, out of the blue, she received a letter from the curator at Auschwitz saying that they knew one thing, and that was that Hannah had been sent to Auschwitz from another camp called Theresienstadt. And so Fumiko tried a whole bunch of other avenues to try and find more information, and then finally, you know, she threw up her hands and said, I'm going to go to Theresienstadt myself, Theresien, and see what I can find out, which she did.
The amazing thing came when Fumiko discovered that Hannah had had a brother and that, in fact, he might still be alive.
Well, she went to the Terezin Ghetto Museum and ended up finding a woman willing to help her there. They found Hannah's name on a transport list, and Hannah's name had a check mark beside it, meaning that she was killed. In fact, everybody on that list had a check mark beside it except one name, and that was the name of George Brady, which was right beside Hannah's name. The woman who was helping Fumiko said it could be a brother, but she cautioned her because the list was made a very long time ago. Anything could have happened to him. He could have been dead. He could have moved to anywhere in the world. But Fumiko pushed and pushed. They managed to find George's name on another list. And in the most amazing coincidence of all, and there are many, many strange miracles and coincidences in this story, the other list from the boys' home had George's name beside another name, which this woman from the museum recognized. And she told Fumiko that that man was alive and well and living somewhere in Prague. And after much more dogged work, she got to meet that man, and it was that man who gave Fumiko George's address in Toronto.
So in the meantime, here's George Brady. He's constructed a life for himself in Toronto, and he has no idea that a group of Japanese children and Fumiko are searching for him.
No idea at all. And he had constructed a good life for himself in Toronto. He had come here in 1951, having lost all his immediate family in the Holocaust. And he decided he was going to live for the future. And he had four kids, and he built a prosperous business. The one thing he could never deal with was the death of his sister, Hannah. And he suffered horrible nightmares about it all his adult life. And then, out of the blue, comes this amazing piece of mail.
You actually brought in a piece of tape that I think continues this story. This is George talking about that very first letter that he got from Fumiko.
Suddenly, I got a letter from Japan, a big envelope. I was wondering who would write to me from Japan. And when I opened it, I couldn't believe it. I just was stunned. You know, I just couldn't believe it. It's to the credit and incredible perseverance of Fumiko that she decided to find who the owner was, but she did manage.
Right after I went home, I wrote to Mr. Brady, but still at that time, I wasn't sure if I could get any response from him. This might remind him of bitter memories, and he might not want to hear such a thing anymore. But a few weeks later, I got a nice letter from him and details about Hannah and also this beautiful photos of Hannah. And I just screamed at that time, and my hands were shaking. And as I read the letter, it was unbelievable. But what really excited me is that Hannah's brother survived. And he now has such a beautiful family. I was so happy about that.
That's George and Fumiko.
Hannah and George had been extremely close, weren't they, as children?
They were extremely close. They came from a very happy, quite cultured family, actually. Both the parents were very artistic and athletic people, and they were the only two Jewish kids in the town of Novo Mesto, which was never an issue for them until the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia and things got bad.
What happened?
Restrictions were announced almost every week. Jews weren't allowed to go to parks. They weren't allowed to travel. And one very important moment for George was when he and Hannah were going to a movie theater to see Snow White, actually, and saw the sign, "No Jews Allowed." And soon they were barred from going to school, which meant that they lost all their friends, which George says was the most painful restriction. And then in March 1941, their mother was arrested by the Gestapo. And not long after that, their father was arrested by the Gestapo. They were taken in by a very brave Christian uncle, who is the person responsible also for saving the family photographs through the war. And the kids stayed with the aunt and uncle until they themselves were deported to Theresienstadt in 42.
Did they ever see their parents again?
No, they didn't. Mrs. Brady was able to get one letter out. She was sent to the Ravensbrück concentration camp, and she got one letter out to the kids. And in the envelope, she had placed four charms that she had made of chewed up bread and toothpaste, with initials of a family member carved into each one. And George still has those charms, which are amazing.
George lost his whole immediate family, his mother, his father, and Hannah. And yet it's the loss of Hannah in particular that haunted him for so long. Why is that, do you think?
Well, he was the big brother. He felt responsible for her. And even though on a rational level it makes no sense, he feels he failed her. And she was a little girl. As I mentioned, he suffered terrible nightmares all his adult life. And George is a very optimistic, happy, jovial person, remarkably so given what he experienced. But he suffered these terrible nightmares all his adult life. And one of the greatest thrills for me about having written the book is that since the publication of the book, his nightmares have stopped. It's just such an extraordinary story that children in Japan could care so much and be so curious about one little girl when all they had was her name on a suitcase that they would hunt all around the world until they reconnected Hannah and her brother, in a sense, and made this little girl real and rescued this piece of history. It's just extraordinary.
It is. And the Holocaust is so enormous. Not just for kids, for adults too. It's hard to comprehend. It's hard to find a way in. And I think one reason that dumpy old brown suitcase captured the imagination of those kids is because it was a way into understanding a story that is almost impossible to understand.
In Japan, the Holocaust is so far away. Some people don't see any connection whatsoever. But when they look at the suitcase, these children were really shocked that she was my age. And they then realized that there were 1.5 million children like Hannah.
Because of the suitcase, it is very strange to me that nearly 6 years ago this tragedy happened, and now suddenly it appears in part of the world where I would have, that would be the last place on the earth where I would have expected that it would appear. And it certainly changed a lot of my life and my family, because everybody is affected by it. And my we have a young daughter who is 17 years old, and she's called Lara Hanna, and she is actually going with me to Japan in March of this year, because we would like to meet some of these kids and help them to find a way of changing the world into a better world.
George Brady and Fumiko Ishioka, two of the people featured in the book Hannah's Suitcase, and Strange Champ spoke with the book's author, Karen Levine. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can get a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Regrets, program number 1211A. To the Best of Our Knowledge, the recipient of the 2005 Peabody Award, is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our intern is John Peterson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.